acted before. I attended two or three auditions in London, and then, once I was down to the last two, I travelled to Los Angeles for a final audition. The hindsight of an adult tells me this was a special moment. But I was still a child, and I had no sense of this being anything massively out of the ordinary. They flew my mum and me to Los Angeles, and we were put up in a crazy huge hotel, which, to my absolute delight, had not only an indoor swimming pool, but also a jacuzzi. What kid doesn't love a jacuzzi? What kid doesn't hilariously pretend it's an enormous farting cauldron? Or was that just me? I was far more interested in reacquainting myself with room service and the Cartoon Network than in the audition. My recollection is that the other boy who was up for the part had a much more hands-on mum than mine. She was reading lines with him, almost directing him. My mum never did anything like that. She never tried to train me, never told me how to say something, always encouraged me to trust my instincts. In many ways, I was completely unprepared. But it was that attitude, I think, that won me the part. Remember the Mother Goose girl? I was once again the complete opposite. I walked into that Hollywood audition free of any anxiety or preconceptions. I was just normal Tom, and I think that's what they were looking for. They wanted to see that I was happy with 12 people watching me, clutching notepads, whispering in each other's ears. Because if I wasn't happy with that, I wouldn't be comfortable on a film set. They wanted to see that I was malleable and directable. They wanted to see that I could deliver a line in more than one way. Most of all, I think they wanted to see that I was relaxed. And I think I was helped more than anything else by the fact that I wanted the interview to be over so I could get back to the hotel and its hilarious farting cauldron. Mum and I returned home to Surrey, and I didn't think too much more about the film. I was still more interested in getting into the A-team for football. Maybe I had a better chance now that my haircut was a bit more streamlined. A few weeks later, though, Mum picked me up from school, and walking back to the car, she said she had news. "You got the part!" I felt a surge of excitement. "Really? Really?" I felt a surge of hunger. "Did you bring me a cheese straw, Mum?" I was obsessed with cheese straws. Still am. Far more so than making films. The decision was made. Mum and I were off to Malaysia for 4 months. I'd barely heard of Malaysia, and none of my family had even been to Asia. We had no idea what to expect, but we were both very excited. Mum quit her job, and off we went. It would have been a lonely 4 months without my mum. It was the first time that I had separated myself from the normality of a day at school with my friends, and I missed it. There was no social media back in those days. I certainly didn't have a mobile phone. I don't think I spoke to any of my friends more than once or twice during the whole 4 months. My dad and brothers came to visit only once for a week. I was the only Western child on set, which was a little disorientating, but I quickly made friends with the locals. I also had my first experience of one-on-one tutoring, which took place for 3 to 6 hours a day in a cold, drafty porter cabin with one tiny window. And although my private tutor, Janet, was a lovely and intelligent lady, I missed the bustle of the classroom, the proximity of my mates, and yes, the opportunity to play up. It's hard to be the class clown in a class of one. On-set tutoring would be a feature of my life throughout my childhood, and I'm afraid I never grew to love it. My obsession at the time was rollerblading. When I wasn't filming or in lessons, I would nag my mum to take pictures of me doing fake grinds and tricks on my rollerblades so I could send them back to my mates and show them what a cool time I was having. But I don't think I fooled anyone. I might have sometimes been lonely out in Malaysia, but I did meet new people from different walks of life, and I can't overstate how much that kind of cultural enrichment helped me later in life. My mum went out of her way to make the experience easier for me. The film's budget was enormous, which meant that the catering was on another level. They served incredible five-star meals in a huge marquee comprising pan-seared this and truffled that. I wouldn't touch any of it. I had, and still have, very plain tastes in food and not much of an appetite. I was more than happy with a chocolate bar and a bag of crisps rather than any of the fancy food on offer. In an attempt to get me to eat something other than sweets, Mum would venture out in the car to find me my favourite chicken nuggets from KFC. She doesn't much like driving around the quiet lanes of Surrey, let alone the busy highways of central Kuala Lumpur, but she braved them. Thanks to her, I was spared a nasty bout of food poisoning that knocked the rest of the cast and crew out for a week. So don't tell me that chicken nuggets are always bad for you. Like any kid, I had my off days, when the homesickness and the isolation got too much. I remember a handful of mornings spent crying, wailing that I didn't want to do it anymore. I remember sweating my butt off in a six-piece linen suit that took an hour to put on and take off. I remember tearfully begging to be allowed to go home. But then by the afternoon, I'd have calmed down and everything would be okay again. And of course, there was Jodie Foster. My brothers have been trying to get me to watch Silence of the Lambs for years, but my mum had rightly shut the door on their attempts to scare the living daylights out of me, although they still managed to sneak in a viewing of Terminator 2. So I had no real concept of quite how famous Jodie was. Of course, I was told that she was very important, so I might have been forgiven for thinking she was more in the John Goodman mould than the Mark Williams mould. If I thought that, I was wrong. Jodie Foster couldn't have been lovelier. I would grow to learn that, on a film set, everything trickles down from the top. If the actor whose name is at the top of the call sheet is difficult, the whole shoot becomes difficult. Jodie Foster and her co-star Chow Yun-Fat exhibited kindness, politeness, patience, and most importantly, enthusiasm for the process. Jodie even managed to keep her cool when I kicked her hard in the face. We were shooting at the time. Jodie played my mother, brought into the court of the King of Siam to provide a Western education for the harem and their children. My character, Louis, gets into an argument with another kid who pins him to the floor. Jodie has to come and separate us. I was blindly bicycle-kicking my legs when I clonked her straight in the mouth. It was not a glancing blow. It was a proper whack, and I'm sure plenty of other actors would have had something to say about it. Not Jodie. She was perfectly lovely about the whole affair, even when the moment of impact was shown several times on the blooper reel at the rap party. Let me take you forwards several years. I'm in my 20s and an audition request comes in. It's for a film called Hitchcock, about the making of the film Psycho and starring Sir Anthony Hopkins. So having done a film as a kid with Jodie Foster, it would be cool to get the Silence of the Lambs clean sweep and work with both of the leads, right? Well, maybe not. The audition came up in the morning and I was called for that very afternoon. There was barely time to read the script, let alone research it. I was reading for the part of Anthony Perkins, who plays Norman Bates. I'd not seen the film, so I watched some footage of him, and it quickly became apparent that I was uniquely unsuited for the part. He was nearly 6'2". I'm not. He had dark hair and dark eyes. I don't. He exuded a kind of psychopathic menace. Well, you can be the judge of that. It was one of the few times that I've ever called my agent from my car outside the building and said, "Do I really have to read for this? I just don't think I'm right for it." Perhaps the chance to work with Anthony Hopkins will come up another time with a more suitable project. They agreed, but persuaded me to turn up anyway, just to show my face to the director and producers. So I turned up. I sat waiting outside the audition room. The door opened and out came the American actress Anna Faris, who had been auditioning before me. In an exaggerated stage whisper, she pointed back into the room and said, "He's in there." "Who's in there?" She was gone before I could ask her. I entered the audition room. As expected, I saw a line of producers dressed sharply along with the director. As not expected, I also saw Sir Anthony Hopkins himself, casually dressed, sitting there, ready to read with me. By this time, I'd seen Silence of the Lambs several times. Now I was about to read a scene with Hannibal Lecter, completely unprepared. My stomach turned over. I was bricking it, horribly aware that I didn't know the script, I didn't know the character, I knew nothing about the film, and I didn't even think I should be here. But I was committed now. So we shook hands and I took a seat opposite him. We get started. Sir Anthony reads the first line. I read my line in a very unimpressive American accent. He stares at me. He blinks. He smiles. He puts his script to one side and says, "I'll tell you what, let's forget the script. Let's talk to you as the character. Let's find out if you really know this character. Know this character? I barely knew the character's name. I knew nothing about him. I was completely out of my depth. Okay, I squeaked. Sir Anthony fixed me with an intense stare. So tell me, he said. Tell me what your character feels about murder. I stared back at him, trying to match his Hannibal Lecter-like intensity, and I said, well, I wish I could remember what I said. It was something so absurd, so traumatically cringeworthy that my brain has blocked it from my memory. He asked me more questions, each more peculiar than the last. What does your character feel about this? What does your character feel about that? My answers went from cringeworthy to downright bizarre. Until finally he said, what does your character feel about children? Children? Children. I said. Yes, said Sir Anthony. I said. What does he like? Said Sir Anthony. He likes children's blood, I said. Shocked silence. I looked at him. He looked at me. The producers looked at each other. I wanted to crawl into the corner and die. Sir Anthony nodded. He cleared his throat and politely said with the tiniest of smiles, thanks for coming in. And what he meant was, that was excruciating. Please leave before you say anything worse. The relief of leaving the building outweighed the skin-crawlingly poor performance with Sir Anthony. Not by much, but enough for me to excitedly call some of my mates to tell them the tale of the worst audition ever. Chapter 7. The Potter Auditions, or When Draco Met Hermione. Until the age of 11, I attended a slightly posh private boys' school called Cranmore. It was no Hogwarts, forget about turrets and lakes and great halls, but it was a very academic place. A place where it was cool to be top of the class and you were respected for good grades rather than, say, bunking off to lark about on a film set. My grandfather helped fund my place. He was an academic, more about him later. And instead of saving up for a college fund, he helped put all four boys through early private education. The idea was to drill in some academia while we were young and impressionable. If I have any academic abilities, basic arithmetic, the idea of reading being something enjoyable, they derive entirely from those years at Cranmore. By the time my stint at private school was almost up, however, my attention was beginning to wander. I distinctly remembered during my last couple of months that there would be a half-hour period after lunch when the teacher would sometimes read us a story out loud. One day he chose some book about a boy wizard living under the stairs. Truth to tell, it wouldn't much have mattered what he was reading. I would have had the same reaction, which was, give it a rest, mate. A boy wizard, not my cup of tea. When I was 11, I changed school. My new school was closer to home and a good deal more down to earth. It was called Howard of Effingham. And if Cranmore taught me my three R's, Howard taught me how to socialise with anyone and everyone. For the first time, I saw students talk back to teachers, practically unheard of at Cranmore. I saw kids smoking on school premises and girls being sent home because their skirts were too short. I had no idea what the future held for me, of course, but to this day, I think my life could have been very different if I hadn't switched schools. Private schools and film sets are both out of the ordinary environments. Howard of Effingham gave me a healthy dose of normality. Not that the transition was easy. For the first week as a year seven, everybody had to wear the uniform of whatever school they had just come from. This meant most kids were in the same garb, a t-shirt and a pair of shorts. For me, and only one other, my mate Stevie, it meant a maroon cap, a blazer, and socks pulled up to my knees. In short, it meant looking like a complete spanner, and there was no shortage of people to tell me so. It didn't make for a straightforward introduction, but looking back, I was glad of the change. I'd grown up thinking that the way to get on in the world was by being a brain box. I was beginning to learn that a far more important and effective skill is the ability to communicate with people from all walks of life. Being placed in a more normal environment would help me do that. It would become even more of an advantage as other parts of my life became less than normal. Up until that point, I'd got away with being a cheeky little boy. In fact, I'd more than got away with it. It had landed me film roles. There comes a time, though, as adolescence hits, that cheekiness develops into something else. I became a bit of a pain in the ass, bit of a reprobate. Don't get me wrong, I lived in a pleasant part of Surrey, and as reprobates went, I was quite a posh one. Really, I was just doing my best to fit into my new environment, just doing my best to be ordinary. And I was ordinary. Sure, I had a bit of acting experience, I'd done some commercials and a couple of films, but nobody cared about that. My new friends were much more interested in skateboarding, amateur pyrotechnics, and sharing a cigarette behind the bike shed. I don't think I even really cared that much about filming. It was a fun sideline, but nothing more. I certainly had no intention for acting to become anything more serious. If I never appeared in another film again, that would be okay. And maybe that would happen. I was developing a bit of a swagger, a slight arrogance. Surely nobody would want to give a part to a kid displaying those sorts of qualities, would they? I had no idea when I was first asked by my agents to audition for a film called Harry Potter and the Philosopher's Stone that it would be any different in terms of scale to the jobs I'd done previously. In my mind, it was another Borrowers, a relatively high-budget film with lots of children and, if I played my cards right, a part for me. But if I didn't get a part, that was okay too. It wasn't the be-all and end-all. There was a good chance something else would come along. It soon became clear, however, from the auditioning process at least, that there were differences. These were open auditions. I'd been asked by my agents to go along, but the vast majority of kids had turned up because they loved the Harry Potter books. I think I was perhaps the only kid at the whole audition who had no idea what they were or how much they meant to people. I'd certainly long forgotten those after-lunch story sessions about the boy wizard. The auditioning process was longer and more drawn out than anything I'd experienced before. Sure, there were no trips to Hollywood, but the casting was distinctly more involved than usual. There were thousands of kids to audition. It took a long time to give each one their individual chance of success. It must have been exhausting for the casting team. I approached it with my usual lack of overt enthusiasm, whereas all the other kids were wildly excited about the prospect of being in a film and clearly knew the book inside out, I was the complete opposite. They stood 30 of us in a line. One of the adults, I would later find out that this was the director, Chris Columbus, went down the line asking each of us which part of the book we were most excited to see on screen. I remember being underwhelmed by the question, as the responses came, clear and certain, Hagrid, Fang, Quidditch. I remember standing there wondering if I could go home soon. It was only when it came to the turn of the kid next to me that I realised not only had I given the question zero thought, I had absolutely no idea what anybody was talking about. Who was Hagrid? What was the Quidditch? My neighbour announced that he was most excited to see Gringotts, and I thought to myself, what the hell are they? Some kind of flying animal, maybe? There was no time to find out. Chris Columbus turned to me. What bit of the book are you most looking forward to seeing, Tom? I stalled. There was an awkward silence in the audition room. I gave my most winning smile and pointed at the Gringotts guy. Same as him, mate, I said. I made a little flapping motion with my arms. Can't wait to see those Gringotts. There was a heavy pause. You mean you're looking forward to seeing Gringotts, the bank? Columbus said. Oh, yeah, I blagged quickly. The bank! Can't wait. He gave me a long look. He knew I was bullshitting. I knew he knew I was bullshitting. He nodded, then continued down the line to a flurry of enthusiastic and informed responses. Oh well, I thought. You win some, you lose some. But the audition wasn't over. Columbus announced that we were going to take a break. You guys just hang out here, he said. Nobody's going to be filming you. Just do what you want to do. It was, of course, a bit of a scam. The cameras were rolling and a huge fluffy boom mic hung over the room. I'd been on sets before. I could tell what was going on and I felt pretty cocky about it. I certainly didn't feel inclined to fall into their trap. A young, curious girl approached me. She had brown, frizzy hair and couldn't have been more than 9 years old. She pointed at the boom mic. What's that? She asked. I glanced up at it, world-weary and slightly full of myself. I might even have sneered a little. What's what? that? It means they're recording us, obviously. I turned my back on her and wandered off, leaving the little girl to gaze wide-eyed around the room. I later found out that her name was Emma Watson. It was her first time in a film environment. I don't know whether anybody overheard our little exchange, but if they did, they'd definitely have seen a little Slytherin in me. The final part of the audition was a one-on-one with Columbus on his own. It's hard to audition a kid. Realistically, how good are they going to be if you simply hand them a monologue and give them the stage? Columbus had a talent, though, for bringing out what he wanted to see in us. We rehearsed a short scene where Harry is asking Hagrid about a dragon's egg. Real dragon's eggs being hard to come by, the prop was an ordinary chicken's egg. The scene was simple. We rehearsed it once, and then they rolled cameras. Interior. An audition room. Day. Tom. As Harry.
What's that, Hagrid?
Columbus, in best Hagrid voice.
Oh, that's a very precious Norwegian ridgeback egg, that is.
Tom.
Wow, a real dragon's egg. Where did you get it?
Columbus.
They're very rare, these are, Harry. They're very hard to come by.
Tom.
Can I hold it?
A beat. Columbus.
Well, all right, but be careful, mind. It's very fragile.
He delicately started to pass the egg towards me, but just as he was about to hand it over, he purposely dropped it. The egg smashed on the floor, dragon everywhere. He watched for my reaction. I think most kids would have felt the need to say something, or would have been alarmed at the turn the scene had taken. I just giggled, little sod that I was. My cheekiness, or cockiness, call it what you will, was evidently no barrier to progress. I was recalled several times after that first day. I read at least a couple of times for Harry, and also for Ron. This time round, there were a few simple lines from the film, but they meant nothing to me, as I still really had no idea who this wizard under the stairs was, or his ginger-haired mate. They gave me round glasses to wear and put a scar on my forehead. I spent the entire day at the studio with others on the shortlist. At one stage, they even dyed my hair Ron-coloured, though happily, I avoided another permed ginger mullet. I started to entertain the idea that perhaps it would be pretty cool to play this Harry Potter kid. But then the auditions were over, and I didn't hear anything for weeks. Oh well, no news is good news, right? Wrong. Our yearly family holidays took place at Eurocamp in France. Mum, Dad, and the four Felton boys would pile into our old blue transit van that had a regular tendency to break down halfway along the auto route. Those were the best holidays of my life, no question. Fresh baguettes, discovering Nutella. I remember hanging out around the tents that summer, idly playing with my yo-yo, while my mum read the newspaper. She called me over to look at a photograph. The picture showed two boys and a girl. One of the boys had dark hair, the other had a ginger mop. The girl had long, brown, frizzy hair. And I immediately recognised her as the kid to whom I'd been less than charitable at the audition. The headline read, "Harry Potter cast revealed." I made an outward show of nonchalance. Oh well, I said, next time. And I wandered off to carry on playing with my yo-yo. I won't lie, there was a twinge of disappointment, but I mastered it quickly, and 10 minutes later, I'd moved on. Maybe it would have been fun to be a wizard, but it wasn't going to happen, so I might as well enjoy my holiday and play with my yo-yo in the sunshine. And then, of course, I was recalled. They didn't want me for Harry or Ron or Hermione. They had another part in mind. Draco Malfoy, the bad guy, apparently. I'd like to tell you that the 12-year-old Tom was inspired to squirrel himself away with some Harry Potter books as a result of being involved with the auditions, but he wasn't. It helped, I think. The filmmakers weren't so much looking for actors, they were looking for people who were these characters. With Daniel, Rupert and Emma, they nailed it. They pretty much are, or at least they were, Harry, Ron and Hermione. And while I like to think Draco and I were not exactly alike, there was surely something about my general nonchalance that caught the eye. Would Draco have gone home to mug up Hermione-like on Harry Potter books? I think not. Would he have blagged his way through a question about which character he was most excited to see on screen? Possibly. You had to act the part, but more importantly, you had to look the part. They decided that they needed to see what I looked like with white hair. It meant the first of many bleachings that would become a staple in my life for the next 10 years. It took a lot longer than I expected to establish my first ever Malfoy hairdo. You can't just go from one colour to another, especially when going lighter. It's a matter of applying layers of peroxide and then topping up with tint. The peroxide burned my head first time round. It felt like fire ants were nibbling at your scalp. Agony. Then they said they'd have to do it again, and I begged them not to. My plea fell on deaf ears. I was straight back in the hairdresser's chair. It initially took 6 or 7 rounds over a matter of days to achieve the colour. It was important for the filmmakers that the colouring was just right. They needed to see how the Malfoy blonde looked next to the Weasley ginger or the Granger brown. I spent hours doing camera tests next to swatches of different colours to give them an idea of how I might look in dark Hogwarts robes, for example, or green and silver Slytherin Quidditch gear. And they needed to know how I would appear on screen next to Harry, Ron, and Hermione. The three principals were there for one of my last auditions so that they could see how our colouring, our heights, and our general demeanours offset against each other. We'd reached the point in the audition process where we needed to read a scene together. There was no messing about with chicken eggs now. So we worked on Harry and Draco's first encounter. I'm a year older than Rupert, 2 years older than Daniel, and nearly 3 years older than Emma. As we moved through the films, that age difference became less important. But there's a big difference between a 12-year-old and a 9-year-old, and my recollection is that I did feel much older. These first moments were as awkward as any first meetings between kids. We were all quite shy, Rupert less so. Off camera, I was probably a little aloof towards these younger kids. I was the product of a family with 3 older brothers, remember, and more than a little of their adolescent standoffishness had rubbed off on me. No doubt some of that transferred to the camera tests. Would it help me get the part, though? A week or two later, I was in the garden of my friend Richie's house playing football. His mum, Janice, shouted out the window, "Tom, your mum's on the phone!" I was a bit irritated. The game wasn't going my way. I ran into the house and impatiently picked up the phone, huffing and puffing. "Yeah? You got it? What? You got the part? What part? Draco!" There was a moment of silence while I let it sink in. "Cool," I said. "This should be fun." Then I said, "Can I go now, Mum? I'm 2-1 down." I'd like to say there were fireworks, but really I just wanted to get back to the footy. I returned to the garden. Richie was there holding the ball impatiently. Very rarely did I feel that I wanted to tell any of my friends about what I was doing in this other part of my life. The indifference I encountered at Crazy Tots years before had taught me that they were unlikely to be remotely interested. But on this occasion, I did feel the need. "What's up?" Richie said. "Not much, I just got this part. Should be fun." "What is it?" "Harry Potter. I'm playing the baddie." "Harry who?" "Don't worry about it. Are we finishing this game or what?" I lost that game, but I won a part. And so it all began. Chapter 8. The Table Read, or Kiss, Kiss, Kiss on the Bum. The scripts were written, the casting was complete, but day one of filming can't be the first time that casts meet script. The filmmakers need to know that everything's going to work when the cameras start rolling, and that it's all sounding as it should. Which is why you need a table read. The clue's in the name. You all sit down at the table, and you read the script out loud. I'd been to table reads before, but nowhere near on this scale. It was more than a little daunting when I saw the size of the cast. We rocked up to a vast hangar at Leavesden Studios to find an enormous square of tables, 20 feet by 20 feet, and a crowd of adult actors, child actors, and the children's chaperones. We kids all said hello and hung out a bit, but much like my character, I thought I was too cool for school. The chaperones were all asked to sit around the edges of the hangar, so while my mum settled down with a nice cup of tea, I took my place at this imposing table. I looked around and took in some of the people that would be part of my life for the next 10 years. Daniel, Rupert, and Emma I'd met, of course. It seems strange to say it now, but theirs were by no means the most famous faces in that hangar. Not that I realised it at the time. Some of the most recognisable British actors of recent years were gathered in that space. Sir Richard Harris was at one end of the table. Dame Maggie Smith at another. Richard Griffiths, John Hurt, Julie Walters. I was surrounded by acting royalty, but I didn't really know who many of them were. I was nervous, but if I had understood what kind of company I was keeping, I'd have been a hell of a lot more nervous. There were exceptions. Along one side of the table was a serious-looking man with a familiar face and a distinguished nose. It was Alan Rickman, and I was terrified. not because of the menace he exuded as Severus Snape, but because I loved the film Robin Hood, Prince of Thieves, and was obsessed with Alan's performance as the dastardly Sheriff of Nottingham. To be in the same room as the Sheriff himself was enough to penetrate even my veneer of schoolboy cockiness. Along another side of the table was a rather less serious-looking man with a comic sneer that makes me laugh to think about it even now. Rick Mail was a hero to me and my brothers, especially Ash. We'd grown up watching The Young Ones and Bottom, and Rick Mail routinely had us on the floor. I couldn't wait to get home and tell him I'd met Rick with a silent P. I might have been surrounded by dames and sirs, but it was Rick that I couldn't believe I was in the room with. In front of me was my script. I'd flicked through it, concentrating on my part, but hadn't read the whole thing. In later films, the scripts were individually watermarked, so if one of them leaked out, they would know whose it was. These were not watermarked, but that's not to understate their importance. The script was gospel. Jo Rowling was rightly very protective over her stories, and Steve Clovis, who adapted the books into screenplays, was on a fairly tight leash. Of course, he couldn't include everything, otherwise the films would have been 7 hours long. But once the script was approved, there was very little wiggle room to mess with it. That said, it was important to hear it out loud because only then can you identify bits that don't work, or are too slow or too boring. And although I didn't know it at the time, the table read can be a ruthless procedure for actors involved. If, on hearing it out loud, the filmmakers don't like one person's accent against another's, or something just doesn't sound right, they'll think nothing of cutting or replacing the actor involved. It happened with Rick Mail, although not at the table read. He played the part of Peeves, the mischievous poltergeist, and filmed all his scenes. You'd think that there couldn't be a more perfect piece of casting, but for some reason or other, his part was cut. We went round the table introducing ourselves. Hi, I'm David Heyman, and I'm one of the producers. Hi, I'm Daniel, and I'm playing Harry Potter.
I'm Richard, and I'm playing Albus Dumbledore.
I'm Tom, and I'm playing Draco Malfoy.
Robbie Coltrane and Emma Watson were sitting next to each other. When their turn came to introduce themselves, they exchanged identities.
I'm Robbie, and I'm playing Hermione Granger.
I'm Emma, and I'm playing Rubius Hagrid.
I found it hilarious at the time. Huge Robbie and tiny Emma swapping parts, and it was typical of Robbie Coltrane to ease any tension in the room with his brilliant sense of humour. He understood that you couldn't have a room full of kids and try to take everything too seriously, and he had a knack of lightening the atmosphere. Not that I wasn't still nervous. The table read started. Everybody was brilliant. I could sense my first lines coming up, pages and pages in advance. I'd highlighted my dialogue and folded the pages it was on. I repeated the lines over to myself in my head. It's true then, what they're saying on the train. Harry Potter has come to Hogwarts. I had a sudden flashback to that moment years before, when I played Tree Number One, forgot my line and waddled off in tears. Surely that wouldn't happen now. My moment came. I hurried through my line, and all was fine. Most of my nervousness disappeared. Halfway through, we had a break. Rick Mail jumped up and shrieked, "Race you to the toilets!" He sprinted off like a demented Pied Piper with 20 kids running after him, me first. Making a film is a serious business. People have invested a lot of money in the project. They have skin in the game, and they want to see that their investment is being properly handled. There were plenty of bigwigs at the table read that day, doing just that. But I had the sense, thanks to people like Robbie and Rick, that filming Harry Potter and the Philosopher's Stone would be a lot of fun. Would it be successful? Would there be any more films? That I didn't know. I didn't even really think about it, to be honest. It was still just another film for me at the time. I didn't expect it to be life-changing. Far more exciting than the table read itself was the opportunity I had, at the end, to pluck up the courage and introduce myself to Rick Mail. It was Ash's birthday coming up, and Mum had his card in her handbag, which I timidly asked him to sign. Very kindly, he obliged. To my absolute and lasting delight, he scrawled, "Happy birthday, Ash. Love, Rick Mail. Kiss, kiss, kiss. On the bum." Then he danced off, Peeves-like, to entertain some other kids. My mum looked at the card, shook her head and frowned. "I really don't know about that, Tom," she said. "I don't think it's appropriate." "Relax, Mum," I told her. "It's a joke." I tucked the card away like it was treasure, and it was treasure. My brothers weren't remotely impressed by my sideline as an actor, but a kiss on the bum from Rick Mail was worth its weight in gold. Chapter 9. Draco and Darwin, or How Malfoy Got His Sneer.
My grandfather is brilliant. His name is Nigel Anstey, and he's a geophysicist by trade. An eminent geophysicist, I might add, with a long list of awards and even an award named after him. When the time came to head off on location to film Philosopher's Stone, and I needed a chaperone to accompany me, Grandpa got the gig. Mum couldn't leave her job yet again, so my grandmother Wendy came down to help her with the house while Grandpa and I hit the road. With his big grey beard, my grandfather looks like Darwin, or if you prefer, like a wise old wizard, which is why, when Chris Columbus first saw him on the staircase at Leavesden Studios, while he was chaperoning me to hair and makeup, he thought he'd make a fantastic Hogwarts professor. Interior, the staircase, Leavesden Studios, day. An elderly bearded gentleman escorts a scrappy blonde kid to the hair and makeup department. They encounter Chris Columbus, who stops for a moment, blinks twice, and inclines his head. Columbus, with the enthusiasm of an American film director. Hey, have you read the book? Gramps, with the reserve of a British academic. I have. Columbus. You'd be a great wizard. Ever thought of acting? Gramps. I have not. Columbus. Well, we'd love to have you at Hogwarts. Would you consider it? A beat. Gramps. I shall. It was unheard of for a family member of the cast to have a cameo in the films. My grandfather was the exception. In the first film, look for him at the far right of the professor's table the first time the students enter the Great Hall, or when Professor Quirrell announces that there's a troll in the dungeon, or sitting next to Lee Jordan during the first Quidditch match. He also had an uncanny resemblance to Richard Harris, so was often used as Dumbledore's body double to line up shots. However, his influence over the film extended to more than some brief cameos in front of the camera. My grandmother enjoys stories about fairies, spirits, magic, ghosts, and goblins. I've inherited that passion from her. My grandfather, on the other hand, is an arch scientist. He's slow, methodical, and very rational. My brothers and I used to play chess with him, and he would repeatedly wipe the floor with us, although he insisted on taking the full 5 minutes between moves. We lost out of boredom half the time. But for all his rationalism, he has a huge passion for the arts. He loves opera, classical and contemporary music, theatre, poetry and film. So he was, I think, pleased to be part of the film and pleased to help me prepare for the role. I had a tendency to stumble when I spoke. My words would run into each other out of sheer enthusiasm, and I even started to develop a slight stammer. My grandfather taught me to slow my speech down, to articulate clearly and precisely. It's an important lesson for any young actor, but my grandfather furnished me with more than just generic advice. He was instrumental in developing one of Draco's most distinctive characteristics, his sneer. Draco would be nothing without his sneer, so he insisted I needed to practice it. We sat down in front of a mirror in a little bed and breakfast on location, trying to get it just so. He told me to imagine that I was smiling about something terrible. If the smile's too big, it's too happy. So he made sure it was small and slimy. Once we got that, he taught me to lift and flare my nostrils as if smelling something disgusting. Perfect, he said. Now do it with one nostril. And finally, he encouraged me to channel into my sneer the frustration I felt at being the youngest, smallest, weakest sibling. There was plenty of frustration to work with. Every younger sibling feels hard done by, and if Draco could treat the rest of the cast the way I felt my brothers sometimes treated me, I'd surely be doing something right. I did what he said. I sat in front of the mirror, and I remembered all the times my brothers had called me a maggot and a runt. I remembered all the times they'd hogged the remote control and never let me get a look in. I remembered the time Jink was winding me up while we were playing on the fourth-hand pool table my dad had picked up from Dorking Car Boot Sale. I'd picked up my cue and hurled it at him like a javelin. Very selfishly, he ducked, and the javelin flew straight through and shattered the glass panels in our back door. Of course, my brothers will always be my best friends, and my home was nothing like Malfoy Manor, but a happy, fun, loving place. Draco is the product of a dark, abusive family, and I'm a product of a loving one. But those sessions with my grandfather in front of the mirror taught me something important about the craft of acting. An actor brings something of themselves to a part, working with elements of his or her own life and fashioning them into something different. I'm not Draco. Draco's not me. But the dividing line is not black and white. It's painted in shades of grey. Chapter 10. Undesirable Number 1, Part 2. Or Gregory Goyle and the Exploding Hot Chocolate. Making a film is a collaboration. The Harry Potter films were the product of hundreds of brilliantly creative imaginations, from Joe Rowling through the art departments and camera teams to some amazing actors. For me, though, the glue that bound them all together for the first two films, the guy who made them what they were, was the director, Chris Columbus. I was a fan of his without even knowing it. He'd made some of my favourite films growing up, including Mrs. Doubtfire and the Home Alone films with Macaulay Culkin, whose own fans I briefly stole as a nipper in New York. But what kid thinks about who the director is when they're watching a film? If I'd been unperturbed about acting alongside Jodie Foster or John Goodman, I was certainly going to be unmoved about working with a director I'd never heard the name of. That soon changed. Columbus quickly became something of a mentor to me on set, and without him, my performances would have been unquestionably different. Columbus had an innate understanding about how to work with children and how to get the best out of us. I guess you don't make a film like Home Alone without having somewhat of a playful, childish touch. He understood that if you put 20 kids in a room together, it won't take long before they're all mucking around. Having thumb wars and playing slapsies were particular favourites. He made no attempt to stifle that. On the contrary, he encouraged it. He had a brilliant ability to not be consumed by how big the project was. He did that by larking about. One of his larks was setting up a little basketball court, just one net, right in the middle of the studios. To start with, it was just for him, so that at lunchtime he could shoot a few hoops. Two or three people joined him. Then I asked if I could play. Sure, dude, come on in, come on in. Eventually, about eight of us would have our lunch, then go and play for 45 minutes. Trouble was, after 15 minutes, my hair and wardrobe would be drenched with sweat, and every ounce of my pale makeup would be slopping down my face. Columbus got told off by hair and makeup for letting us kids get into that state. Sorry, dude, he told me, genuinely regretful. I want you to play, but we just can't. I still snuck on a few times after that, but I kept my sweating to a minimum. Columbus was not a big advocate of telling us what to do or how to act. He possessed a critical knowledge of what made a shot work from behind his monitor. He then seemed to know exactly what to say to each individual to get what he needed out of us. It was also often more about what he didn't say than what he did say. His strategy was sometimes to fix the environment so that the performances of his child actors happened naturally and organically. The best example of this is when we first entered the Great Hall. All the kids were purposely kept away from that set until the day we were to film the scene. In the meantime, Columbus made sure that everything was magnificently perfect. The tables were set, the background artists all in place. Hundreds of flaming candles hung from the ceiling on fishing lines, which later melted, causing the candles to plummet. Dumbledore, Hagrid, Snape, and my grandpa sat at the head table in full regalia. There was no starry sky, of course, just an enormous scaffold for a ceiling, but it was impossible to enter that space for the first time and not be awestruck. The reaction of the Hogwarts first years that you see on screen was genuine. They were as astonished as they looked, just as Columbus cleverly intended. He didn't have to tell us to do anything. He just had to engineer the perfect circumstances for the response he was after. Of course, I was still outwardly displaying some of my world-weary, meh, nothing-impresses-me attitude, so despite being as impressed as everyone else, I may have worn a slightly less enchanted expression. I've no doubt that this was all part of Columbus's plan. My attitude fitted the part perfectly. Columbus's enthusiasm was relentless. His constant refrain was, "Awesome, man! That's awesome!" We actually started mimicking him towards the end of the second film with our own takes on, "Awesome, man!" But I'm absolutely certain he wouldn't have minded that. In fact, he would have encouraged it. He wanted us to be cheeky, to be having fun. because he knew that it would translate directly onto the screen. One-on-one, his directing technique was equally cunning. Because he was such a great guy, the young cast were all keen to impress him, and I was no different. He used to make a big deal of how much he loved to hate Draco. Every time I sneered or oozed superiority, he would call, "Cut!" screw up his face and with a smile say, "Oh, you bastard!" Rather than tell me what he wanted, he would respond positively to those parts of my performance that pleased him. In doing so, he would tease the performance out of me without stress or demands. For me, that is a sign of a great director. It can't all be shits and giggles, though. Columbus's laid-back attitude was precision-engineered to get the best out of his child actors. But we couldn't be too laid-back. With scores of kids on the set, that way bedlam lay. So how do you keep a host of high-spirited hooligans under control when the boss is more focused on making sure they're having fun? Somebody needed to play, if not exactly bad cop to Columbus's good cop, then at least strict cop. Enter Chris Carreras, the second crucial Chris on the Harry Potter set. Carreras was the first assistant director, Columbus's right-hand man. That means he runs the set. It was his responsibility to ensure that everything happened smoothly and on time, that everybody knew what they were doing and when they were doing it. No mean feat when you have a sea of excitable kids to keep in line. Carreras was the right man for the job. He's one of the best established, most respected first ADs in the industry. And he rightly ran that set like a drill sergeant. Wherever he went, he had a black whistle round his neck. And on day one, he gave a speech to us all. Like Dumbledore, announcing to the school that the third floor corridor was out of bounds to those who did not want to die a most painful death, Carreras held up his whistle and laid down the law. "If I blow this whistle and you don't stop talking, I will send you home." Carreras was a nice guy, but we were all a little afraid of him. I don't suppose he ever would have sent us home, but he had the gravitas and commanded enough respect for us to believe that he might. So whenever he blew that bloody whistle, every kid in earshot stopped what they were doing, shut their pie holes, and listened. With maybe the occasional exception. Josh Herdman, who played Goyle, and I used to get into a fair bit of trouble. I distinctly remember the very first day we shot at King's Cross Station. It was one of the few days my dad chaperoned me, and I'm happy to report that I wasn't the only Felton to cause trouble that day. He walked on set and was understandably impressed at the sight of all the props, cameras, crowds of background artists, and of course the platform 9 3/4 sign, which had been erected for the first time ever and had to be kept under wraps from the outside world. Dad enthusiastically took out his camera to take a photograph of it. This was, of course, strictly forbidden and contrary to set etiquette. An assistant director saw him from behind and shouted that someone was taking pictures. Cue a swarm of people furiously trying to locate the dastardly paparazzo. Dad quickly hid his camera, pointed in another direction and shouted, "He went that way!" And so he smoothly avoided a substantial telling off. I was less lucky. It was freezing cold that day, so they provided a Costa Coffee hot chocolate for all the kids. I guzzled mine down and put my empty cup on the ground. Josh crushed it flat with his heel. He made it look pretty cool. Josh, however, sipped his slowly and had barely drunk any when Carreras's whistle blew. He put the cup on the ground and stood to attention. I was a little less obedient. Not to be outdone, and assuming that Josh's cup was also empty, I jumped as high in the air as I could and landed on it with both flat feet. It's quite incredible the mess an exploding hot chocolate can make to every set of Hogwarts robes in a 12-foot radius. The last thing a filmmaker on a tight schedule wants is a bunch of soggy, dirty teenagers whose costumes require emergency cleaning. Carreras's face dropped. He strode up to us and gave us a look that would have had Snape himself quaking in his boots. A look that said, "You little shit!" I was properly scared of Carreras in that moment and genuinely thought my career as Draco might be over before it had really begun. Happily, I detected the slightest of smiles as he reprimanded me. I'd gotten away with it, although we were never allowed hot chocolate on set again. And while I'd like to say that being the focus of Chris Carreras' wrath kept us in line from that moment on, I'm afraid it would not be the truth. From the very first moment I was offered a part in the Harry Potter films, the rules were clear. I wasn't allowed to do anything dangerous. Skiing? No chance. Extreme sports? You've got to be joking. It was the Barclaycard advert all over again. The restrictions made sense. Nobody wants to spend millions of pounds shooting half a film, only to find that you have to reshoot a big chunk of it because one of your actors has to spend the next 6 months in hospital with 3 broken bones. Even minor injuries can, and did, cause a problem. When we were shooting the second film, my friend Richie, whose house I'd been at when my mum called to say I'd landed the role of Draco, came round for a sleepover. We slept in the front room, me on the couch, Richie on the floor. At the time, the Felton family were the proud new owners of a cordless telephone, and Richie and I spent the night making prank calls. The lights were out so that Mum wouldn't know we were still awake. "Chuck us the phone," I whispered excitedly. Richie did just that. He chucked it. Hard. You'd think that being part of the Slytherin Quidditch team, I'd be good with my hands, but as I reached out to catch the phone, my seeker skills let me down. The phone cracked me solidly on the forehead. Shit. We fumbled our way towards the light switch and flicked it on. Richie stared at me. "What?" I said. "What? Can you see something?" "Oh my God," Richie breathed. A bump the size of a golden snitch had immediately appeared on my forehead. Not great under even normal circumstances. Especially not great when you have a big scene to shoot the following morning in the Great Hall. Mum called the set first thing. Tom's had a bit of an accident. Right, replied a long-suffering production person. How bad is it?
It's not that noticeable, she lied. Just a tiny bump on the head.
But I walked into hair and makeup that morning to a shocked silence. I looked like something out of a Tom and Jerry cartoon. A makeup lady whisked me into the chair and did her very best to cover up my ridiculous wound. But every shot of me in the Great Hall that day had to be taken from my good side, thanks to Richie's dodgy aim and my inept catching. So the rules were strictly enforced. Do nothing dangerous. But rules are meant to be broken, right? That was certainly my approach in those early days of Potter. One of our first location shoots took place in Alnwick Castle in Northumberland, where we filmed the broomstick lesson scene with Zoe Wanamaker as Madam Hooch. That one scene took 3 or 4 days at least, time enough for me to get into a good deal of trouble with Alfie Enoch, who played Dean Thomas. Alfie was a year older than me, and a smart, funny guy. He had a professional chaperone rather than his parents or a family member, and like me, had a penchant for skateboarding. Which was, of course, strictly forbidden. A reckless young actor could do himself a lot of harm on a skateboard. I'd managed, though, to smuggle one into my suitcase. I soon identified one of those perfectly tarmacked hills that you sometimes find in the middle of nowhere and persuaded Alfie that it would be a good idea for us to sneak off and try it out. It wasn't a good idea. As an idea, it had disaster written all over it. But we didn't care about that. We scarpered up the hill and put it through its paces. I think we had the sense not to stand up on the skateboard, but to ride it more like a bobsleigh. It didn't help our cause one little bit when Alfie's chaperone found us wildly speeding down this hill with little thought for our own safety or for the hassle we might cause the film if we hurt ourselves. She went absolutely nuts. We found ourselves in extreme disgrace and I was swiftly marked out as a bad influence. I'd like to think of that as poppycock. Truth is, it wasn't. Almost immediately after filming began, life had started to mirror art, and I found myself in a little clique with Jamie and Josh, Crab and Goyle. Josh and I had already made a name for ourselves as troublemakers with the crew, thanks to the exploding hot chocolate at King's Cross, but we soon gravitated towards explosions of a different kind. We were filming in and around Newcastle and staying at the same hotel, which was cool because we got to hang out after filming. We were very excited when Josh revealed he had managed to bring a blank-firing replica pistol with him. This was something that my mum would never in a million years have let me have anything to do with, and rightly so. It looked identical to a normal handgun, although it would only fire a blank round. No bullets, but still not the kind of thing you want in the hands of a trio of mischievous young teenagers. And that, of course, was half the thrill.
We were desperate to fire the gun, but we couldn't think of a good place to do it. Obviously, the hotel was out, and even we knew it would be stupid to allow it anywhere near set. In the end, we waited until the witching hour before we sneaked off to the basement level of a nearby multi-story car park. The level was empty, and I suppose our backwards reasoning was that this would be a safe place to fire the thing without scaring anybody, and, crucially, without being caught. We failed to take into account the acoustics. If you've ever been in one of those car parks, you'll know how they echo. So imagine the noise a gun makes, albeit a blank firer. Josh cocked the weapon. We braced ourselves. He squeezed the trigger. The noise was ear-splitting. It rang out and echoed through the whole car park. If we wanted to fire the gun subtly, we'd chosen pretty much the worst place in Newcastle to do it. We stared at each other in horror as the retort of the gunshot refused to fade. It reverberated and lingered like a howler in the Great Hall. So we ran. I don't think I've ever sprinted so fast. Sweating and breathless with panic, we tore out of the car park, back to the hotel, and shut ourselves in our rooms. I was terrified that someone might have seen us, that we were going to be reported and hauled up in front of the police, or worse, in front of David Heyman, the producer. What would happen then? Surely we'd be sent home. Surely that would be the end of it. Surely even Chris Columbus would have a sense of humour failure at our stupid exploits. I waited, cold dread in my veins for the knock on the door, or worse, for the pop of Chris Carreras' whistle. Neither came. We dodged a bullet. Almost literally. And while we were never so stupid again as to try to discharge a blank fire in a public car park, there's a bond that develops between people when they get up to no good and get away with it. Draco, Crab, and Goyle were a troublesome trio on the page and on the screen. Some people might take the view that the Slytherin trio were worse in real life, at least in those early days. I couldn't possibly comment.
Chapter 11. A Day on Set, or Severus Snape's Sausage Sandwich. Perhaps you imagine a day's filming at the Harry Potter studio set to be a day of wizarding glamour or Hollywood star treatment. Allow me to burst your bubble. Don't get me wrong, being an actor on a film set certainly beats being at school, but I've found that the reality is different to most people's expectation. A typical studio day would start with a knock on my front door at 6 in the morning. It would be Jimmy, we affectionately called him Crackbean, my driver of 9 years, bright and perky and ready to take me to work. Like any teenager, I was the very opposite of bright and perky at that time of day. I would stumble reluctantly out of bed and walk zombie-like, clutching a pillow, to the car, a dark green BMW 7 Series with a long wheelbase that I most definitely did not need. Ensconced in the passenger seat, I'd become an instant carcoleptic and snooze through the hour and a half it took to get from home to the studios, where Jimmy would drop me at the iconic Door 5. Door 5 led to the dressing rooms, the production office, and the art department. It was the shabbiest, most run-down block I'd ever seen. Old rickety stairs, sticky checkerboard lino on the floor. More often than not, it would be pissing down with rain outside, or the Tupperware grey of the skies would remind you that this was definitely England, not Hollywood. Still bleary-eyed, I would go to find some breakfast in the canteen. Hash browns and beans, good British dodge to fill up a hungry teenager. Then I'd stagger up those rickety stairs to the production office to get my sides. These were mini scripts that comprised the day's order of play and the lines I'd need to know. I was the despair of the second assistant directors, whose job it was to produce and distribute the sides, because I was forever losing them. Next stop, my dressing room. My route would take me through the art department. It was a truly astonishing place, where supremely talented artists sat round a long Gringotts-esque table, fashioning props for the wizarding world out of clay or building exquisitely precise scale models of various sets. At the end of the art department was the office of David Heyman. Being called there was like being called to see the headmaster, usually to discuss something important. Daniel, Emma, and Rupert had their dressing rooms together at the end of one corridor, with a ping pong table nearby. Side note, young Emma Watson was a very adept ping pong player. My dressing room was on a different corridor. A plaque on the door said, Draco Malfoy.
It was the done thing for the plaques to give the character's name rather than the actor's. For the fifth film, Alan Rickman changed the label on his dressing room door to The Half-Blood Prince. If anyone thought my dressing room would be a cocoon of outrageous comfort and privilege, they would be disabused of that notion once they'd stepped inside. It was a tiny room, painted white, with a metal clothes rail and a plastic chair. My Hogwarts robes, or whatever costume was required for the day, would be hanging on the rail. I'd change into it and make my way to hair and makeup. Hair and makeup on the Potter films was a massive operation. The artist would have to get through 20 or 30 actors a day, and I'd probably spend an hour in the chair each morning. More if I was getting my roots done, which happened once every 9 days. From time to time, I'd go through all that and end up not being used for the day's filming. Timothy Spall once told me he acts for free. He's only paid to wait. We had to be there and ready on the off chance we were needed for a scene, which often we weren't. This could be a bit frustrating, though it was worse for someone like Warwick Davis, who played Professor Flitwick and Griphook. It would take 3 or 4 hours to apply his hair and makeup, and another couple of hours to remove it. A long time in the chair to end up not being called on set. So now I'm in full Draco regalia. My robes are flowing and my bleached hair is just so. Which means it's time to go to school. And the school in question, alas, was not Hogwarts, but another plain white room down another corridor where one of a number of tutors would be waiting for us. There was a legal requirement that all school-aged kids should receive a minimum of 3 hours of tutoring every day. That requirement was literally observed to the millisecond. Our time in tutoring was measured using stopwatches. The moment we picked our pens up, the clock was on. The moment we put them down to go to set, it was off. Even a 5-minute stint would go towards our allotted 3 hours, and the stop-start nature of the process was hardly conducive to effective learning. Not that I was particularly interested in learning effectively. I hated tutoring. It was nothing to do with the tutors. My mum had recommended Janet, who had tutored me on Anna and the King, and she headed up a team of tutors who did their very best with us. I'd be in a class of 3, tops, often with Jamie or Josh because we were generally filming in the same scenes, but my attention was always elsewhere. The moment the call came that we were needed for blocking, I was out of there. There were 8 stages at Leavesden, named A to H. Each stage was essentially a huge warehouse, where they would build the sets in astonishing detail. Into one warehouse, they imported countless tons of topsoil and planted actual trees to create the Forbidden Forest. Another contained the water tank, which was the largest in the world at the time. As I've already mentioned, the Great Hall was a masterpiece, situated in the final stage, furthest from door 5. It was a long walk, or if you were lucky, a fun drive in a golf buggy. I tried skateboarding there on many an occasion, and even tried driving myself once or twice. I was furiously reprimanded each time. The journey would take us past myriad white tents, where technicians and other crew members were hard at work on whatever was needed for that day's filming. As the films progressed, the way would be littered with pieces of scenery from previous films. You'd pass enormous wizard chess pieces from Philosopher's Stone, or the sky blue Ford Anglia, or most impressively, the huge snakehead statues that lined the entrance to the Chamber of Secrets. The statues were exquisitely made and looked lifelike and weighty. Only when you got up close did you realize they were made of lightweight polystyrene and weighed practically nothing. Other stages were floor to ceiling with props and knickknacks that would have been a Harry Potter fan's dream to explore. The most impressive set, which came along in the later films, was the Room of Requirement. It was brimful of random wizarding paraphernalia. There were trunks and chests, musical instruments, globes, vials, and strange stuffed animals. There were chairs and books piled to the sky, tilting and teetering so they looked like they were about to fall at any minute. In fact, they were held in place by steel rods through the middle. The place was stuffed with all manner of curiosities that you typically find in an old antique shop, but by the thousand. You could have spent a year wandering around that set and still not have taken it all in. It was very cool. Blocking is the process of running through a scene so that when the time comes to film it, everybody knows what they have to do, when they have to do it, and most importantly, where they have to stand.
The process is important for the director and the actors because it gives them the opportunity to try out their lines, their movements, and their facial expressions in a variety of different ways. For me, the direction was usually to stand in the corner and look miserable, or to go to my usual seat in the Great Hall and be myself. The adult actors had more leeway. It was instructive to watch performers of their caliber evolve their scenes throughout the process. While the text was gospel, the interpretation was fluid, and the scenes would gradually come alive. The blocking process was equally important for the camera team, because a scene can have many moving parts, and they have to work out the various angles they need to capture. We had the luxury of a huge camera team and plenty of time, so this was an involved job. Imagine filming a scene in the Great Hall. There might be a shot of the doors opening, a shot of the ceiling, of Harry, Ron, and Hermione at the Gryffindor table, of Hagrid and Dumbledore at the high table. There might be an argument between Harry and Draco. And the geniuses behind the camera will need to work out how to shoot over Harry's shoulder to get Draco's response. They'll place little beanbags on the floor so that everyone remembers their positions. Often the eye lines are very different to what feels natural, so they put bits of tape around the camera lens so you knew where to look. Once the blocking was done, we'd still be nowhere near ready to film. It could sometimes take 2 or 3 hours to light the set. And not only